Welcome, folks. Hope you had a chance to finish the quiz, and if not, it's too late to start anyway. So, any questions before we start? Because we're going to hit the real options running. We'll talk about valuing a patent. We're going to talk about valuing undeveloped reserves, and we're going to wrap up the real options section probably on Wednesday. So let's start at the start of the class test in terms of real options and what it is that makes for real options. So let's assume a small startup company has come up with a new cell phone technology, promises to speed up download speed, smoother interface. They do a cost analysis. It turns out it'll cost $2 billion to implement this technology. And based on what they know right now, the expected cash flows from doing this are $1.5 billion. Let's start with the easy question, Aaron. Should they implement the technology? It costs $2 billion. They'll get $1.5 billion.
No, since they would be losing money.
Net present value is minus 500. Now, let's assume, though, that you work for Apple or Samsung, and you think that this technology could be viable in the future. Right now, it's not viable. Would you be willing to pay for this non-viable technology if there are like 15 years left on the patent?
Maybe. I think that would depend.
Maybe is a good answer, right? Because right now you're saying this is not viable. Why would I pay for it? Why might you still pay for a non-viable technology with a lot of problems?
Because in the hopes that it became viable and the cash flows may be more than $2 billion.
Things can change, right? I mean, there was a time when people looked at technologies that today are huge blockbusters and said, that's never going to work. But things can change. One of the things we're going to talk about today is why you might pay for a non-viable technology, the rights to do something that right now are not worth very much, but could be worth in the future. It's an option argument. Let's take a second one. Okay? Let's assume that you do buy this non-viable technology. Let's talk about how different aspects of it might affect how much you pay. You're still looking at the same non-viable technology. Would you pay more or less if I gave you more years left in the patent life? In other words, if I told you there are 15 years as opposed to five, would you pay more or less? Because the more time I give you for something, for your hope to play out, the more valuable the technology becomes. Now here comes a tricky one, Courtney. Let's suppose that I take this technology and there's a lot more uncertainty in the future about how this business will unfold, how the technology will change. How will that affect how much you pay? Will it increase the value or decrease the value if I increase the uncertainty?
Maybe decrease?
Normally, that would be the right answer, right? Increasing risk is a bad thing. What makes this different? Right now, this technology is not viable. Let's take an extreme example. And I told you there's no uncertainty at all about the future. It's going to stay non-viable for the rest of eternity. Uncertainty is now my friend. That's the only way this non-viable technology is going to become viable. And that lies at the heart of why options are different from everything else. Uncertainty becomes your ally. And the more uncertainty there is about the future, the more you're willing to pay for a non-viable technology in that particular area. It turns on its head almost everything we think about in value and risk, right? But you can see why. You want uncertainty because uncertainty is the only way that Aaron's hope that this will become viable actually will play out. Now, let's actually try to put this into practice today, because as I said, it's not an easy option to value. But to get this process started, I'm going to go back to what we were talking about. We're talking about the Black-Scholes model. And I told you one of the limitations of the traditional Black-Scholes model was it was designed to value options on dividend protected assets. You know what I mean by dividend protected? When a dividend is paid, the strike price gets adjusted down. And I also told you there are no dividend protected options in the world. So it's almost an abstraction that really cannot be used. So over the last 30 or 40 years, people have created variants on the Black-Scholes, which allow it to be used on an asset that does pay a dividend. And to see how this plays out, I'm going to take the Black-Scholes model, and you saw this a couple of pages. This is a traditional Black-Scholes, but here are the adjustments I'm going to make. In a normal Black-Scholes, I just take the current stock price times N of DY. But when I adjust for dividends, here's what I'm going to assume. Every time a dividend gets paid, my stock price drops by roughly the amount of the dividend. That's the ex-dividend day behavior. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the current stock price and discount the stock price back today, assuming the dividend is going to knock down my price every year. So as an example, if I have a 1% dividend yield and this is a 10-year option, I'm going to act like my stock price drops 1% every year to reflect the dividend yield. So it reduces the current stock price, but the expected price drop that's going to come about because the dividend gets paid. That's the first adjustment. Here's the second one. Remember how we created that replicating portfolio with a call option? We went and bought shares of stock with borrowed money. And the risk-free rate was what we paid on that borrowed money. But remember, in this case, the shares pay a dividend. So you know what I can do? I can use the dividend to offset some of the interest expense. So if I have a 4% interest rate and a 1% dividend yield, I can take the 1% dividend and use it to offset some of that 4%, leaving me with a net cost of only 3%. This is called a carrying cost. And what you will notice inside the brackets is when I do my D1 and D2 now, instead of just taking the riskless rate, I net out the dividend yield from the riskless rate because that dividend yield can be used to pay my interest expense. So two adjustments. One is I reduce my stock price by the expected drop that's going to happen because the dividends. The second is I net out the dividends against the interest expenses to create a carrying cost that's lower because I have a dividend paying stock. This is the equation that we're going to be using in a lot of real option scenarios. It's a dividend-adjusted Black-Scholes model where you're bringing in dividends through both the stock price and the carrying cost for the replicating portfolio. But the Black-Scholes is still a replicating portfolio. It's unlike the binomial, we can see the replicating portfolio. In the Black-Scholes, it's kind of hidden behind those numbers. And incidentally, if you can value a call, you can also value a put. And the reason is very simple. When you have a put and a call with the same strike price and the same maturity, there's this equation that has to exist for there to be no arbitrage. It's called put-call parity. The value of the put and the value of the put are kind of linked up at the hip. So with the value of the call, you can actually value the put as well. So that's all the option pricing I'm going to do because we're going to talk about using these models to value real options. Now, if you open up many real options textbooks, and there are quite a few right now, one of the prompts of these books are written by purists. Purists who think everything is a real option. And many of these books will insist that you cannot use a Black-Scholes model to value. No. That you cannot use a Black-Scholes model to value a real option for a simple reason. The original Black-Scholes was designed to value. Remember, we said European options. Options can be exercised only at expiration. Most real options get exercised well before expiration. Let me give you an example. One of the things we're going to talk about is how a patent gives you an option. Say a patent is a 15-year life. If you really have a patent that's going to make you money, you want to exercise the patent well before the end of the 15th year because you wait till the end of the 15th year, you've given up much of the protection you get from the patent. The nature of real options, you're going to exercise them before expiration. In other words, they're American options, not European options. So many purists say, why are you using a Black-Scholes? It's a European option pricing model to value real options, which are American options. Point taken. But I'm still going to use the Black-Scholes, and here's my defense. The Black-Scholes model is far easier to use with real options than a traditional binomial model. And I'm going to get a floor price, which means this might not be the price I would attach an American option, but it's a floor price. The American option should trade at a premium on this price. So even though the Black-Scholes is not directly useful to value an American option, I can still get a floor value by using a Black-Scholes, and it's so much easier to do. So that set up, let's talk about some real options, right? Incidentally, for those of you who don't like options because they're like elaborate and they're abstract, you can actually build to what looks like a real option by using what's called decision trees. Decision trees are something you learn in operations research or statistics, where in each branch you attach probabilities, you come up with cash flows, and you come up with an expected value. And if you do a decision tree with enough elaborate detail, you'll actually get the same value that you get from an option pricing model. The one thing about decision trees is at each stage, we have time, you've got to do discounting, and if your risk changes across the decision tree, it's not easy to do. But I'm saying if you don't like to use option pricing, there's a way in which you can use decision trees to arrive at pretty much the same answer. In fact, one place where decision trees actually can be used is in pharmaceutical companies. Right? So this is actually an example of a decision tree to value a drug to treat diabetes. So basically, this is the valuation done at the time the research is initiated. So at each stage in the process, here's what you'll see in a decision tree. You'll see probabilities of success and failure and what the cash flows will be at each stage. So right now, you're going to test. The test fails, you abandon. The test succeeds, then you go ahead and invest more. In each stage, what you're doing, you're looking to see what information you get and what the cash flows will be. But you can already see that this can get really messy for an actual drug to draw the entire decision tree. But if you have an analysis where you have a judgment on the probabilities that you can make, and the probabilities are discrete, you either succeed or fail. That's why drugs work so well in this setup. You can actually not use options and use a decision tree and arrive at pretty much the same value for that option. So that's the lead-in to what we're going to do. We're going to talk about options. And with every option we're going to look at, we're going to ask three questions. Is there an option embedded here? So I'm going to draw the payoff diagram to back up my point that there is an option. Second, I'm going to ask, is there exclusivity? The more exclusivity I have, the greater the option value. And then I'm going to ask, can I use an option pricing model? And remember, to use an option pricing model, I need to be able to trade the underlying asset and trade the option. And the closer I get to meeting all three conditions, the more I can use real options. So to start the real options discussion, I'm going to talk about options in capital budgeting projects. I'm going to argue that the way we teach investment analysis in traditional capital budgeting is static. You look at a project, you project out the cash flows, you come up with a risk-adjusted discount rate, you take the net present value. The net present value is greater than zero, you accept the project. If it's less than zero, you reject the project. Don't abandon that lesson. It's still a useful one. But I'm going to argue that when you do a traditional capital budgeting analysis, you take expected cash flows and discount them back at a risk-adjusted discount rate, there are three options you might miss. The first is the option to delay an investment. A project might have a negative net present value today, but it could have a positive net present value in the future. The rights to a bad project can still be worth a lot. This is the way we started today's class. You have a non-viable technology. It's a bad project, negative net present value, but it could still be worth a lot. The second of these options I want to talk about is the option to expand, which is, a project can be a bad project, but it can give you the rights to do other things that are potentially valuable, the option to expand. And finally, there is the option to walk away from your mistakes. It's called the option to abandon. The option to delay, the option to expand, the option to abandon. We're going to value all three of these options and talk about the implications we face then when we're valuing a company or valuing a business or valuing an individual project. Because all of these options are valued and could potentially tilt the scales and make you take a project that on the face of it looks like a bad project. Let's start with the option to delay. You have the exclusive rights to a project. That's the starting point for an option to delay. You look at the project today, the project is a bad project. But things can change. The cost of making the product can change, the market can get bigger. What looks like a negative net present value project could become a positive net present value project. You might say that's hopeful thinking. It could be, but you have that potential. So if I were to draw this in terms of a payoff diagram, here's what it would look like. The cost of taking the project becomes the strike price of the option. If the project turns good, you're going to take the project and make the difference. And of course, you will take the project only if the present value to cash flows exceeds the cost of taking the project. So right now, the project has a negative net present value, but that could change. And if it does change, you're going to take the project and make the difference. And of course, your hope might turn out to be misplaced, in which case, what have you lost? You've lost whatever you've spent to get the rights to this project. Let me ask you a question. How do you get the rights to a project? Prithvi, what are the two ways a company can end up getting rights to a project?
Not sure, actually.
One is you can buy it, right?
Yeah.
Somebody else comes up with it, you buy the right. But if you are developing the rights internally, if you're a pharmaceutical company, how do you end up with a patent?
Apply for a patent, like if you have a technology.
But to apply for a patent, first you got to do the research. The money you spent on R&D becomes the cost of acquiring the option. You can actually argue that what companies spend on R&D is essentially the money they're spending to buy options for the future. And guess what? That could turn out to be completely wasted if the patent never becomes commercial. The option to delay a project fundamentally starts with you having an exclusive right, but whatever you spend to get that exclusive right becomes almost the equivalent of the cost of the option. I'm going to use this in two contexts. Yeah? First, I'm going to argue that product patent can be valued as an option. Let me explain. With a patent, what do you have? You have the rights to develop this patent into a commercial product. Keyword is right. Nobody can hold a gun to your head and say you have to develop it. You can choose to develop it. When would you choose to develop it? If you think the present value of the costs, if you think the present value of the cash flows you will get from developing the patent exceeds the cost of developing the patent, you will develop it and make the difference, V minus I. So V is the cash flow and I is the initial investment. If V is greater than I, you will develop the patent. Of course, the value of the cash flows is less than I, then you will basically sit on the patent and hope that something good happens. That looks a lot like a call option, right? In fact, if you take a patent, the cost of converting the patent into a commercial product becomes the strike price. The present value of the cash flows you will get from developing the patent becomes the equivalent of the stock price. And of course, if you never develop the patent, the cost that you spend to acquire the patent will become like the cost of the option. A patent fits all of the requirements for a real option. You can see it in the payoff diagram. So let's talk about how you would value a patent. Where would you go get the inputs in order to be able to apply whether you can do it? Remember, ultimately, option pricing models require at least five inputs. You need a stock price, you need a strike price, you need a life of the option, you need a riskless rate, and need a variance in the value of the underlying asset. Think of what the underlying asset is with a patent. It's whatever commercial product you will produce with the patent. So if you take the present value of the cash flows you would get from developing the patent today, so don't play games about what you do in the future. If you develop the patent today, what will your cash flows look like? So if you're producing you've come up with a drug to treat MS or diabetes, what you do is if I develop the drug today, what would my cash flows look like in year one, year two, year three, year four for the development period? The present value of those cash flows, discounted back at your cost of capital, whatever the right discount rate is, will become the equivalent of the S in the model. Now, when you ask people to do this, you know what the reaction is going to be, right? I don't know how big the market is. I'm very uncertain about the future. That's good. Go ahead and make your best estimate. Give me your present value. That's going to become the S in the model. The variance in that value is going to be tricky. You can't go look it up on Bloomberg because it's not a traded asset. But remember how we did Monte Carlo simulations, where you get a value not just under one scenario, but under multiple ones. If you can do a Monte Carlo simulation on this project, the variance in present values that you get across the simulations can become the variance, use the variance, the option. But that's going to be a lot of work, right? Monte Carlo simulation, you've got to come up with distributions. If you're lazy, I'll give you a shortcut. Let's suppose your patent is in biotechnology. And I told you that the variance in stock prices for publicly traded biotechnology firms is 30%. I know this is cheating, but you might say, look, this is a biotechnology patent and biotechnology firms that are traded have this standard deviation. I'm going to use that as my variance in my option pricing model. It's a shortcut. It might not be perfect, but it's certainly quicker than running a Monte Carlo simulation. So the S in the model becomes the present value of the cash flows from developing the patent. The standard deviation variance become the variance in that present value. The exercise price of this option would be the cost of converting the patent into a commercial product. The factories you have to build, the salesmen you have to hire. So that'll become the K. You know what the expiration of this option is? It's a patent. Patents don't give you property rights in perpetuity. It might be 15 years, it might be 20 years. Whatever the remaining life of the patent is, becomes the life of this option. Because at the end of the period, the option's done. And finally, every year, I'm going to add something that'll make it likely that you'll exercise the option. Because in any traditional option pricing, if there are no dividends, you'll hold the option through expiration. But with a patent, we know that if it's a good patent, you will develop the patent. And here's what's going to trigger it. Normally, the reason you don't exercise options early is because there's a time premium on the option. In other words, you will always get more by looking at the option, selling the option, than actually exercising the option. So I'm going to create a cost here. And here's what the cost is. Let's say this option becomes, this patent becomes viable in year two. You have 15 years left on the patent. Of course, you can wait an extra year, right? Time is always good. You learn more. But if you wait an extra year, you know what you're going to give up? One out of the remaining 15 years of protection from competition. A patent gives you protection against competition, and waiting means you're giving up one of those 15 years. In fact, if I wanted to do a shortcut, if there were 15 years left in the patent and this patent is viable, I'm giving up 1/15th of my cash flows by not developing the patent right now. So I know that's abstract, but let's try this out. This was from about 20 years ago. A company called Biogen, it's still around now. It's now a much bigger company that was then, had come up with a drug called Avonex. And they felt it was going to be a blockbuster drug to treat MS. So 17 years left in the patent. I'm going to take that particular example and use it. And here's the advantage I had in this example. I was able to get my hands on an actual internal set of cash flows that Biogen had done on how big Avonex could become as a blockbuster drug. Have any of you seen how pharmaceutical companies forecast cash flows and drugs? It's actually a very morbid process. Here's what they start with. They start with the number of people in the population who have MS. So, you know, they take a percent of the population, 8% of the population of MS, they'll start with that number. Then they'll take the percentage of that number who go to a doctor. And guess what? It's not 100%. And they'll take the percentage of people who go to a doctor who get the right diagnosis. And guess what? That's not 100% either. And they'll get the percentage of people who get the right diagnosis who can afford the medication. And that's not 100% either. And then they'll take the percent of people who can afford the medication will actually take the medication. For every 100 people with MS, if you're lucky, you might end up at 7 or 8 people who end up taking your medication. And then they project out cash flows based on the pricing of the drug and take a present value. And that's what Biogen had done with Avonex. They'd estimated a present value to cash flows if they developed the drug instantaneously to be $3.42 billion. So this is just the present value of cash flows from developing the drug right away. They also estimated that the cost of developing this drug to them as a company would be about $2.875 billion. You're saying, why is it so expensive? Biogen had never actually produced a drug on their own. They'd actually patented drugs, but sold them off to the big pharma companies. So they didn't have a sales force. They didn't have any production facilities. $2.875 billion. Let me pause right there. If this were a capital budgeting project and I asked you what the net present value of this project is, Tom, what's the net present value of this project? The present value of cash flows is $3,422 million. The investment you will need to get this project going is $2,875. What's the net present value of the project? Tom Galante? What's the net present value of this project?
Sorry, I'm not sure.
So if I develop the project, the present value of the cash flows I will get is $3,422 million. It'll cost me $2,875 million to get the project going. Net present value is just the difference between the two, right? Which is about $547 million. So if this were capital budgeting 101, that's where I'd be done. But remember, I haven't taken the project yet. There are 17 years left on the patent. The riskless rate was 6.7%. And this is a very risky business, a lot of uncertainty. In fact, to capture the uncertainty, I cheated. I looked at the variance of biotech firms that were publicly traded, and that variance is 0.224. What does that mean? This 3,422 million could become 4.5 billion, could become 2.5 billion. There's a lot of uncertainty about the future. I'm going to value this patent as an option. And here's what the inputs are going to look like. S is going to be 3,422. That's the cash flows I would get if I developed today. K would be the cost of developing. I have 17 years, that's the life of the option, 6.7% riskless rate, 22.4% variance. My expected cost of delay, remember this is a viable drug. If I don't develop it, what do I give up? I give up one of the 17 years of protection I get from competition. Cost of delay is 5.89%, 1/17. I take the present value and I work through the value that I get for the option, D1, D2, if you remember the Black-Scholes. The value that I get for the option is 907 million. Remember what the net present value was? It's 547 million, right? It's like magic. I've taken 547 million and saying, hey, the option here is worth 907 million. See, where's the extra 360 million coming from? The 907 minus 547, that's the premium that comes from the optionality. Remember I said the attraction of real options, I'm gonna let you add a premium on top of the DCF. There's my, and why is there a premium? Because I'm uncertain about the future. Now do you see why people love real options? The more ignorant you are about the future, the more uncertain you're about the future, the greater the premium I add to your present value. Because that uncertainty acts as your ally. The reason this is difficult to do at regular pharmaceutical companies, it takes a lot of work. Right, you got to get the present value to cash flows, which means it's very difficult to do from the outside. You got to work at a Merck or a Pfizer to have these numbers with you so you can do the present value to cash flows. If you want to do a Monte Carlo simulation, you really have to understand the business and think about the distributions in these variables. But the value of this patent as an option is 907 million. I took that example. And I changed a couple of things. I said, what will happen to the value of the option if I wait 1 year, 2 years, holding all else constant? See this blue line? That's the value of my option. The purple line is what I would get by exercising the option. Right now, it doesn't make sense for me to exercise because if I exercise the option and develop the drug, I'm replacing a $907 million value asset with a $547 million asset. So guess what? I'm going to wait. And wait. And if you have MS, that's some really bad news. Here's a drug that is promising that you want in the market tomorrow, right? But given the present values, I'm going to wait about maybe 8 years before I develop the drug because that's when the blue line crosses the purple line, that I make more money. In practice, though, pharmaceutical companies tend to develop drugs the moment they become viable. In other words, they don't seem to do this in practice. If pharmaceutical drugs were viewed as options, you would expect a lot more delay in this process than you actually see. And I think the reasons are twofold. One is this assumes you're the only game in town, that if you wait a year, that all you lose is 1/17 of the cash flows. But what if Merck is working on its own MS drug? And you have only 3 years before that drug gets developed. You know why you don't have to, you don't want to wait? Because if you wait, you don't lose 1/17 of your cash flows, you lose 1/3 of your cash flows. The more competition there is in the business, the less likely it is that you will wait to develop a drug. And that's good news for people with the disease. You want drugs to be developed when they become viable, not in waited 3, 4, 5 years. But if you're a monopoly pharmaceutical company, you know what this graph tells me? You're not going to get new drugs very often because when you create a new drug, you're eating into your existing revenues. Why would you want to come up with a new ulcer drug if Zantac is working so well? But looking at this through the eyes of an option gives you a sense of where it is that the extra value comes from. It comes from uncertainty about the future and what do you think it might do to help you on this particular patent. So if you gave me a company with patents, one way I can value is the traditional DCF, right? Where I can give you a higher growth rate because of all these promising patents. But here's the other way I could value. I could value your existing products as the first slice using a DCF model. Then I can value the patents you have, just like I did with Avonex, each patent as an option. And then I have a third layer, which is kind of messy. You have a continuing R&D department that might produce more options in the future. I value the value of having that R&D department, how much excess value did you create? So if you have a small, I would never do this for Merck or Pfizer. I'd go crazy, think of how many patents they have. But if you gave me a small pharmaceutical company, you could value the patent in three slices. In fact, in 97, I valued Biogen. I first valued its two existing products. It had two commercial products, which had already been licensed out. And when you license out a drug, there are a couple of ways you can license it out. One is you can get a fixed fee where the company licensing out pays you $5 million a year for the next 15 years. Or you can get a fee that's a function of revenues and earnings. You're saying, who cares? If you get a fixed fee from a Merck or a Pfizer, which is what Biogen had, you know what discount rate you should use to discount those fees? It should be the risk that you will not get the cash flows. And that risk has nothing to do with you. It's got to do with, in this case, if we look at Merck and Pfizer, and they're the companies that license these drugs and they're AA ratings. And the cost of debt for a AA rating will become the discount rate you use to discount these cash flows. I mean, this goes back to an old rule. The discount rate for a set of cash flows should reflect the uncertainty in the cash flows, not the entity, the risk of the entity receiving the cash flows. So when I took the $50 million that they had as after-tax cash flows, because these were fixed fees, and discounted the back of the pre-tax cost of debt for the companies, the guaranteeing companies, which is 7%, what I get is a present value is $397.13 million. The present value of the licensing fees, because they're fixed, are discounted back at the pre-tax cost of debt of the companies making those guarantees. That gives me the value of existing drugs. I have the value of the patent. The only patent they had was Avonex. The third and the trickiest layer was valuing how much Biogen's future R&D was going to be worth. And here I made some assumptions. I first started with how much Biogen was spending on R&D. It was spending about $100 million, growing at about 20% a year. And I assumed that I knew how much they would spend. I also assumed that every dollar of R&D, and this is the big assumption, would create $1.25 value. Based on Biogen's history, based on the pharmaceutical business, which means I'm assuming they're earning excess returns. But every dollar investment for the next 10 years would create $1.25. After year 10, I'm going to assume we get to steady state. You're not making any excess returns. So here's how I'm going to value the future R&D. The second column, in the third column, you see how much I'm spending, $100 million growing at 20% a year for the next 10 years. The second column is actually the third column times 1.25, $120 million R&D. If I create $1.25 in value, it gives me $150 million. So I create $30 million in excess value. That's very uncertain. So I discounted back at a much higher discount rate, 15%. What I get as a present value, $318 million, is the value of future R&D. Valuing Biogen as a company, in three slices, here's what I have. The first slice is existing drugs that they've licensed out, that's the $397 million. The second slice is Avonex as a drug, $907 million. The third slice is future R&D, $318 million. You add them up, the total value that you get for the company is $1.622 billion. So very little cash and no debt, so I divide it by the number of shares, get a value per share of $45.70. Again, don't try this for big pharma companies. It's too complicated. But if you have a small pharma company with one licensed product and one drug that's been patented but in the pipeline, this is a way in which you can get a value for the company. But you have to make sure you don't end up double counting. So don't do a traditional DCF, use a high growth rate, and on top of that, add a patent back, because that's double counting. But you can value the existing drug, value the patent, and if you can, even value the ongoing R&D. So let's put real option to the test. Now, is there an option? Yes. The payoff is built around the cash flows. The contingency is the present value. The cash flows exceed the investment cost. You're going to take the patent, or you're going to commercialize the patent. If not, you're just going to sit on it. Is there exclusivity? Yes, as long as the law backs you up. If you have a legal system of patents are not enforced and anybody can do whatever you're doing and not get, you really don't get any compensation, the exclusivity is gone. But there is exclusivity as long as the law backs you up. And thirdly, can I use an option pricing model? Barely. Do you see why? The underlying asset is the drug that comes out of the patent that can't be traded. The patent itself is not traded, though sometimes you might see companies buying and selling it. Neither the underlying asset nor the option is traded. So it's not that I cannot use an option pricing model, but it's going to be much more difficult for me to monetize that model. So when you look at patents, when you look at licenses, when you look at anything where you have an exclusive right, even if that right is not viable today, viewed as an option, you can basically see that you might be willing to pay for it. So you remember when we started the class with a non-viable technology. The S is less than the K, right? It's an out-of-the-money option. There's a lot of uncertainty in the future and I have a long time that I can wait on that option. An out-of-the-money option can still have value today. One of the mistakes I think companies often make is they look at the value of a right by looking at how much is it worth if I do it today. And they assume that if it's not viable today, that the right is not worth much. And often that will come back to haunt you if that right ends up being a right you sell off for a fraction of what you should be charging, and it becomes a viable right 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years down the road. Any questions on valuing patents as options? Go ahead, David.
I guess I'm struggling a little bit with the limited downside piece when we're looking at these real cases, like in capital budgeting. It feels like if you buy a call option, you can transact on that instantly if you're in the money and you can sell it, or you can walk away. But if you're in the drug case, if your projections are wrong and you take the
project. No, wait. For the projections to actually play out, you actually have to develop the drug into a product. So until you develop the drug, all you spend is the R&D to accumulate the patent. So let's stop right there, right? Yeah. If you do nothing from now on, you're done, right? So whatever you spent on the patent, so that's a fixed cost. It's like the cost of the option. If you decide to develop the patent into a drug, of course, there's uncertainty in the future. You try to capture that when you take the present value, the cash flows to come up with the S. Could you be wrong about the S? Absolutely. In hindsight, you might look back and say, I wish we hadn't developed the patent. But you could say that about almost any investment, right?
Yeah, but could you say that about just like a really plain vanilla call option that you buy on, GE?
S in your hand. And this is the problem with not being able to trade. So what you're pointing to is the last thing that I mentioned. If you could trade the drug, you know what you'd do right after you develop the drug? If you felt uncertain about the future, you'd sell the drug to a buyer at whatever that S is, in this case, $3.422 billion, and you could monetize the option. What you're pointing to is because I cannot trade the drug or the patent, I end up with this number that I can't monetize. Right, I can't lock in the $3.422 billion. So that makes it more difficult to apply the option pricing model because the underlying asset and option are not and patent are not traded. Now, the next one we're going to look at is oil reserves. And there you're actually going to be able to lock in the cash flows because you know what you do? You take the oil out of the ground, you sell the oil, collect the cash flows. It's a much more, I think, tangible case where the option can be monetized and therefore you're willing to pay that amount. So what that will mean is if I came to you with Avonex and I said, will you pay me $907 million? Your response might be no. I'll pay you $605 million or $600 million, a little bit more than the $547, but I'm not willing to go all the way to $907 because I can't lock in the profit. Any other questions on patents? So let's talk about natural resource options. Okay. Let's say you're an oil company. You've developed reserves and you have undeveloped reserves. Developed reserves are the reserves you've developed. The oil is coming out of the ground. Undeveloped reserves are reserves you can choose to develop. Let's look at what drives the decision. When you have undeveloped reserves, and you can pick any part of the world, in Saudi Arabia, in Canada, in the North Sea, the cost of developing the reserve becomes the equivalent of the strike price, right? So whatever that is, 100 million, 500 million, let's call that X, cost of developing the reserve. What will drive whether you develop the reserve is how much oil you think is under the ground and what value you get from the oil. If the value of the oil under the ground exceeds the cost of developing the reserve, you will develop the reserve and keep the difference. And of course, that never happens. Just sit on the reserve, hoping that something good will happen, which in this case, the oil price might go up. So if I were to draw this as a payoff diagram, here's what it'll look like. The cost of developing the reserve becomes equivalent to the strike price. The value of the oil under the ground becomes the value, the equivalent of S. And of course, you acquired this reserve either by doing exploration yourself, like R&D, or buying the reserves from somebody else. That becomes the cost of the option. Undeveloped reserves at a natural resource company have all of the characteristics of a call option. And in fact, you can value it as such if you can somehow get the inputs. And let's see what the inputs would look like to value undeveloped reserves as an option. Let's start with the S. The S in this model will be the value of the oil that you think is under the ground. How do you know how much oil is under the ground? This is why you hire those geologists, they tap the rocks and they say 100 million barrels here. So you trust your geologists. You take that oil reserve, you multiply by expected oil prices, and you can even lock in those prices with futures markets. You get the value of the oil under the ground. That becomes the S in the model. So if you develop the reserve today, what would that look like? The cost in developing the reserve will depend on which part of the world you're in. If it's Canada, the cost might be much greater because you got to go 5,000 feet under the ground, unfreeze the oil, do whatever you need to do. If it's Saudi Arabia, it might be trivial. But it's based on where you are in the world, and the cost of actually developing the reserve becomes the strike price. The time to expiration is a little tricky. Most oil companies don't get their reserves in perpetuity. They usually bid for them in auctions, and they're given the right to develop those reserves the next 15 years, the next 20 years, the next 25 years. That life becomes the life of the option, however much time you have to develop those reserves. So that becomes the T in the option. As for the variance, this is actually a traded asset. What are you worried about the oil under the ground? Oil is a traded asset. So when I ask you how uncertain are you about the future, your uncertainty is really about what the oil price is going to be. And that you can at least get a sense of by looking at how much oil prices are moving in the market. But there is a cost to not developing a reserve once it becomes viable. And the cost is, if you had developed the reserve, you'd have got oil out of the ground, you'd have got cash flows. By choosing not to develop the reserve, I'm going to call this a cost of delaying exercise, you're giving up those cash flows. So that becomes like the dividend yield in the model. In other words, I'm trying to take the Black-Scholes and put SKR, T sigma, and the dividend yield, and I'm trying to come up with the inputs. One final point about oil reserves or natural resource reserves that is a practical issue you've got to deal with. Is let's say oil prices jump to $120 a barrel next week. A lot of reserves are going to get viable, right? Let's say you're at ExxonMobil and you decide you're going to develop those reserves quickly. Even if you decide to develop the reserves next week, oil's not going to come out of the ground probably a year, 2 years, because you've got to put the rigs in. It takes a while for this production to come into play. There's a lag between when you decide to exercise the option and when the oil comes out of the ground, which adds to David's point, which is exercise the option because oil prices went up. By the time the oil actually comes out of the ground, oil prices might be back down again. There's an uncertainty factor here, which makes it more risky than a traditional option. So let's take this, let's take a company and see how we could make this play out. A company called Gulf Oil. It was actually the target of a takeover attempt in the early 1980s when oil companies were being targeted all over the world because they were cash cows and people thought they were cheap. And one reason Gulf Oil was targeted is because it had huge undeveloped reserves, 3.038 billion barrels of oil under the ground. At the time that they were targeted, it was estimated it cost about $10 a barrel to develop these reserves. So basically, if they wanted to develop all of these reserves right away, 3,038 times 10 is about 30.38 billion. Think of that as a strike price. Developing the reserves today would cost you 30.38 billion. The average oil price at the time was $22.38. And the cost, variable cost of getting a barrel out was about $7. So basically they made about $15.38 per barrel on the 3,038 barrels under the ground. They had an average life left on these reserves of about 12 years. It's the life of the option. T-bond rate was 9%. 9%, that's not a typo. That was actually the T-bond rate then. And oil prices were volatile. In fact, the variance in oil price was 0.03. Okay? Variances will tend to be really low numbers because we have a 20% standard deviation. It's 0.2, right? 0.2 squared is 0.04. It's not 0.4, it's 0.00. So in a sense, when you look at variances, you're going to see very low numbers, 0.02, 0.03, 0.04. In this case, the variance is 0.03. I have everything I need to value these reserves as options. So let me try. The value of the oil under the ground, 3,038 million barrel, $15.38 per barrel. There's a development lag of 2 years, which means you've got to wait 2 years to get the oil out of the ground. The way I reflect that, it looks like a present value, but basically what I'm doing is I'm removing the cash flows of the first 2 years. It's almost like I'm doing capital budgeting, but I'm saying, look, if I decide to develop the reserves, I get no cash flows in year one, no cash flows in year two, and then starting in year three, I get the reserves producing cash flows. The value that I get of the oil under the ground with a two-year lag is $42.38 billion. The cost of developing these reserves is $30.38 billion. Again, if I paused right there and asked you, what's the discounted cash flow valuation of these undeveloped reserves? 42.38 minus 30.38 is $12 billion. In other words, if I did a traditional DCF valuation of these undeveloped reserves, the value of the reserves would be $12 billion. But there's an optionality. I can wait. And because I can wait up to 12 years, the variance in oil prices is 0.03. And I give up 5% in cash flows every year. I basically have all of the inputs to an option pricing model. The D1, D2, N of D1, N of D2. Now, remember when we talked about N of D1 and N of D2, I said they look a lot like probabilities. In fact, N of D2 is often in option pricing referred to as a risk neutral probability that S will be greater than K. In other words, this reserve, there's an 85.4% chance that the reserves will be developed. Why is it so high? Because the reserves are already viable and there's a very high chance that they will be developed. And valued as options, the value that I get for these reserves is $13.3 billion. Remember, the DCF value is $12 billion. I'm adding an extra $1.3 billion to those reserves. Why? Because oil prices are volatile. In fact, if you take this example and make the oil price variance zero, in other words, there's no volatility, the value of the option will drop to $12 billion, and basically the DCF value will also be your option value. Put simply, the more uncertain you get about future oil prices, the more value there will be to undeveloped reserves. And that's across the board. If you take a company like Petrobras that gets 70% of its value from undeveloped reserves, more volatility in oil prices will make those undeveloped reserves more valuable because of the optionality. With developed reserves, you don't have the same degree. You can try to adjust production, but it's limited optionality. So again, as with the patent, you can see the allure of options is you add a premium on top of a DCF. And as with patents, I decide to value the whole company. And if you're valuing an oil company using this approach, here's how you have to do it. You have to take the developed reserves and value the developed reserves using a traditional DCF. So what you see here is the developed reserves throw off $915 million in cash flows every year. The cost of capital for an oil company is 12.5%. The present value of $915 million every year for the next 10 years is about $5.07 billion. That is the value of my developed reserves producing cash flows for the next 10 years. You add to that the value of the option, $13.3 billion. You get a total value of the firm of $18.4 billion. So I'm getting to the same endpoint I got with the DCF, but I'm just getting there differently. Rather than doing the present value of cash flows and building in growth, I'm doing developed reserves first, undeveloped reserves as an option, adding them up, and coming up with an overall value for the firm and a value per share. So any natural resource company, gold mining company, oil company, you could argue has this optionality. And that optionality has to be factored in when you think about how much you pay for natural resource companies. Any questions on natural resource companies? No. Incidentally, natural resource companies come much closer to meeting the requirements for option pricing, right? The underlying asset is traded. Oil, right? It's traded, you know, you can buy and sell. Even the natural resource reserves are traded. Oil companies buy and sell reserves all the time. There's an active market for it. It is the one real option that comes closest to meeting every one of our requirements. There's an option, there's exclusivity. In fact, the exclusivity of the oil companies comes from the fact that there's only so much oil under the ground. And it comes pretty close to meeting our option pricing requirements. Real options have their deepest roots in natural resource companies, and you can see why. It comes closer to meeting all your requirements for it to be something we can apply an option pricing model to come up with the value. So last March, if you remember, oil prices dropped to, what did they drop to? $25 a barrel, I think, at the worst March of 2020. You know that 80% of the reserves around the world became non-viable at a $25 oil price. If you took that to the next logical limit, there were people saying, why are we paying any money for oil companies? They should be worth nothing. What they were missing is if you have reserves and you have the rights to develop these reserves, no company in its right mind is going to be developing the reserves in March of 2020. But you're paying the price because oil prices can go up. And in fact, now oil prices are back up to what, $65 a barrel. Those reserves that were non-viable a year ago are back to being viable reserves. And that's exactly what you're paying for. When you think of these reserves as options, is that possibility that prices could change and what's non-viable today could become viable in the future. So that's the option to delay. You see it play out in licenses, you see it play out in patents, you see it play out in undeveloped reserves. Let's talk about the option to expand. Talk about the option to expand. Usually you're talking about two projects that are bound together for whatever reason. And to make this process as clear as possible, I'm going to assume that the first project is a negative net present value project. So you know going in, you're going to lose money. So there's no hopeless thinking about this could turn around. You know you're going to lose money. Saying, so why would I do it? Because it gives you the rights to a second project. And that second project could be worth a lot of money. It's a rationale that a lot of companies use when they decide to start a business in China or India, because these businesses that they start could lose their money, but the reason they're okay with it is because they think by starting these businesses or acquiring these businesses, they get the rights to do other things that could be worth a lot. That's the option to expand. So let's draw out what the payoff diagram is going to look on the option to expand. So you've taken a bad project. You know you've taken a bad project. You overpaid for an emerging market company. You know you've overpaid. That overpayment or negative net present value becomes a cost of this option. The option you get is the option to expand into China, into India, into artificial intelligence. That becomes equivalent of the strike price. The present value, the cash flows you think you will get by expanding becomes equivalent of the stock price. If the present value of the cash flows exceeds the cost of expanding, you will expand and make the difference. If not, you write off whatever you spent trying on that first project, the negative net present value. I know it sounds, again, example, but let me give you a very simplistic example of how this would work out. Let's assume that you're valuing a software company. A software company produces antivirus software. So you do a traditional valuation. You project out the free cash flows. You discount back at the cost of capital. You come up with a value of $115 million. Your DCF is done. And then I tell you, you know what? Along the way, as this company produces and sells its software, it's acquiring a customer base. Each customer that buys its software becomes part of this platform. And that platform can be used to produce a database software program because you've learned about your customers in the process of running this viral software. I'm going to produce a database software program. And then I ask you, well, what do you think you can make? And say, well, it'll cost us about $500 million to produce this database software. And right now, based on what we know about this business, we think we will make about $40 million a year for the next 10 years. If I stop right there, you're saying, this is stupid. You're going to spend $500 million to produce a software. You make $40 million for the next 10 years. You don't even have to do discounting to see this is a negative net present value project. But then I say, you know what? But there's a lot of uncertainty in this business. That $40 million could become $80 or $100 million a year or 2 years from now. In fact, the uncertainty is captured in a standard deviation of 50% in that value. The risk-free rate is 3%. So right now, my DCF value is $115 million. I'm trying to value this platform you will be creating of your customers. Let's see how we'd value the platform. The S here will be the present value of entering that business today. Present value of $40 million a year for the next 10 years at the cost of capital for that business is $226 million. The K is $500 million. Right now, this is a deep out of the money option. You'd be crazy to develop the software right now. But the standard deviation is 50%. There's a lot of uncertainty in the future. Over the next 5 years, we value this as an option. The value that you get for this option to expand is $56 million. This is like magic. You have a terrible project. And to add it, you have a terrible project. We are very uncertain about the future. Because you have exclusive rights to this project for the next 5 years, I'm willing to pay an extra $56 million for the company. Now, I remember 3 years ago at the peak of the Cambridge Analytica scandals, when Facebook dropped as low as 135, I valued the company using a traditional discounted cash flow model. And that traditional discounted cash flow model, I took the only business Facebook is in right now, which is online advertising. And I, you know, I brought in the expected cost to the privacy laws that I thought were coming. And I came up with a value of about $140 per share. Stock was trading at 135. But I bought the shares anyway, even though it looked only very, very mildly undervalued. You know what my rationale was? That $140 per share comes from only online advertising. Facebook has a user base of 2.5 billion people who are on its ecosystem about an hour every day. Right now, they haven't figured out how to make other ways to make money on this platform. But if they do, guess what you have? You have an incredibly valuable option. That's what we're capturing with this option to expand. Right now, you can't think of what that might be. Right now, the other things they could do, like retailing or entertainment, might not make sense. But the fact that right now it doesn't make sense doesn't mean that it will never make sense. Now, in the case of Facebook, I didn't actually put numbers and come up with the value of the option. My argument, it's worth a lot. But since I can already break even with just online advertising, this would be icing on the cake. And there's a lot of icing on the cake here because of the platform that they built. This, I think, is what's drawing people to platform companies, which is look at that platform, look at the other stuff you can do with the platform. And maybe that additional stuff, no, but you got to be careful that you don't get drawn into just basing this on how big is the platform. You could ask about exclusivity and you got to ask about the other things. But you know, the fact is, you know, the potential market being big is not sufficient. You need to bring in that second factor. Is there enough exclusivity? Not all platforms equally valuable. The reason the Facebook platform is so valuable is not only because it's big, but because it has a user base that is intense, which spends a lot of time on its platform. The Twitter platform is worth a lot less. Why? Because people come and go. They don't stay on Twitter for hours at a stretch. At least normal people don't. But basically what you're looking at when you look at platforms is not just the number of people, but also what else can I do with this platform? And for companies where you can potentially do lots of other things, there is an optionality, even if you never put numbers on that optionality. Any questions about the option to expand? Go ahead.
So I was just wondering, I was thinking of Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp. So will that be considered as an option?
They bought a pure option. They bought a pure option because at the time that they bought it, and I'm actually glad you brought it up. At the time that you bought it, almost no one on WhatsApp was paying. Remember they had that one, you could get it free or you could pay a dollar or something. Almost no one was paying it. So they had almost no revenues. Of course, they were losing money. And in fact, people said, is Facebook crazy? Why would you buy a company with no revenues and big operating losses? They were not buying a company. They were buying 400 million users who didn't overlap very well with their user base. They bought an Asian presence that they would not have had without WhatsApp. But buying WhatsApp was just the first step. They bought the option. To exercise the option, they've got to now develop that platform to the point where they can actually, and you know what? They're still working on it. WhatsApp is still not technically a moneymaker for Facebook. It's like a freebie. But guess what? The clock is ticking. One thing that Facebook has done very well over their entire life is take options like Instagram when they first bought it for $1 billion. People said, why are you doing that? Who'd be looking at Instagram pictures? Now Instagram is very much part of the Facebook ecosystem. My prediction is 5 years from now, WhatsApp is going to be very much part of the Facebook ecosystem. That when you're spending time in WhatsApp, you're in the Facebook ecosystem and you're probably seeing ads and you're probably seeing other stuff that Facebook is offering. Maybe WhatsApp will be the part of the platform. You don't see ads, but there'll be other products that you're offered for which you will pay money. But that WhatsApp acquisition definitely was at least from my perspective, they were buying an option.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I'm going to stop there because I know with the quiz, it's been, you've already had a long day. So I will see you on Wednesday. Take care.